of monsters, not knowing what is going to happen. I still have to walk in there, and the people that support me and surround me are walking with me, and that they will need to walk with others who are going through the same. We need to stop what is happening.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. We'll certainly report what happens on Monday. President Biden is in office for another, 10 days, and we will be there on every day raising these questions. Ravi Ragbir, his lawyer Alina Das, co-director of Immigrants' Rights Clinic at NYU School of Law, and Amy Gottlieb, U.S. Migration Director for the American Friends Service Committee. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Anjali Kamat, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamiri Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Hannah Elias, our Executive Director, Julie Crosby, Becca Staley's our Director, John Randolph, Paul Powell. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you so much for joining us.
Una excusa para no cumplir lo que prometes. Apenado y afligido llamas y dices que te arrepientes. Tú me dices que me amas, que lo nuestro.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon gives a permit to a controversial biofuel refinery on the Columbia River.
Multnomah County names the location of a new sobering center.
And in national news, hundreds of incarcerated firefighters are among those battling the blazes in Los Angeles.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 10th, 2025. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Luna Winchester. Thousands of structures have burned and at least 10 are dead in the Los Angeles County wildfires. Six fires are still burning and fire weather is not letting up. Winds calmed this afternoon but are expected to pick up again over the weekend. Some containment progress has been made, though, as out-of-state crews arrive as necessary reinforcement. High winds have meant firefighting airplanes and helicopters have not been able to be used. 180,000 people are under evacuation orders. The Palisades and Eaton fires are the most destructive fires in LA County history and are among the most destructive in California history. The first fire began Tuesday morning, and tens of thousands of acres have burned since.
More than 7,500 people are helping fight the historic Southern California wildfires, and more than 900 of them are incarcerated. The California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation said today that 939 fire camp firefighters have been, quote, working around the clock, cutting fire lanes, and removing fuel from behind structures to slow fire spread, end quote. California actually has a history of using incarcerated firefighters dating back to 1915. In fact, Prison laborers have been used to respond to a variety of emergencies and disasters nationwide for hundreds of years. Some see that practice as being exploitative. The Department of Corrections says individuals who are part of the California program are there voluntarily and that they are being paid between $5 and $10 per day, with some additional pay provided during emergencies. This practice does fill critical personnel gaps. LA area crews have been battling multiple large blazes at the same time, which stretched the county's emergency response resources and staff. California is actually one of more than a dozen states that operates conservation camps, commonly known as fire camps, for incarcerated people to train to fight fires and respond to other disasters. They also respond to floods and other emergencies and do community service work in areas close to their camps. The program was first established in 1915 but expanded during World War II after forestry staff left their jobs to fight in the war. Incarcerated people were called upon as replacements, and 41 camps were established. There are now 35 such camps in California, all of which are minimum security facilities. These firefighting prisoners must be deemed physically and mentally fit, have exhibited good behavior, and must have 8 years or less remaining on their sentence. Opponents have questioned how voluntary the assignments really are, since California's Corrections Department requires inmates to work. Prison labor programs actually have historical ties to the end of the Civil War and the passage of the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery, quote, except as a punishment for a crime, end quote. Prisons use that exception frequently. A 2018 Time magazine investigation found that incarcerated firefighters are at a higher risk for serious injuries and are more than four times as likely to get cuts, bruises, or broken bones compared to professional firefighters working the same fires. California's Corrections Department said incarcerated people do not face disciplinary action if they choose not to serve their time in a fire camp.
Multnomah County plans to buy a building in southeast Portland to build a new 24-hour sobering and crisis stabilization center. The county says they will buy a building at 1901 Southeast Grand Avenue in the Central East Side Industrial District. Right now, it's an empty warehouse, but they plan to make 50 sobering beds available. The center is intended to be a place where first responders can drop off people who are under the influence and help them stabilize, instead of bringing them to jail or to the emergency room. The center will also help connect people to local treatment and recovery resources. The Temporary Coordinated Care Pathway Center has been in place for deflection services in the meantime, and it's expected to add 13 sobering beds this spring. Portland has had a sobering center before. It closed in 2019 after 30 years. That was around the time that fentanyl started taking over the Portland drug market. Staff there said they couldn't handle just how severe the medical and mental health needs were for people. County Commissioner Shannon Singleton said in the announcement, quote, "Making sure that people in our community can actually access sobering services is the key need to navigating the substance use crisis in our streets. Long waits and red tapes keep people from getting the help they need. We're all committed to cutting through that and making it easier to get sober," end quote. The next community meeting on the sobering center will be sometime in March. It's not yet known when the center can be open.
The Metro Supportive Housing Services, or SHS, tax could be headed back to the ballot for some revisions and extensions. It was first passed in 2020 and taxed high-income households to fund homeless services for the next 10 years. It's brought in good money, more than expected, but the Metro counties, Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas have struggled in the past to spend that money on time. Last year, all of the funds were spent on time. Metro Council President Lynn Peterson released an outline of a revision to the supportive housing tax earlier today. If referred to the voters and passed, it would allow the funds to go towards affordable housing development along with homeless services. It would extend the tax to 2050 and decrease the tax rate in 2031 from 1% to 0.75%. The hope is that an extended life on the tax would mean homeless service providers can rely on the funding for longer. It's not clear yet how much of the money might be set aside for developing affordable housing, a key contributor to the homelessness crisis. The Metro Council will vote on whether to send the revised tax to the voters for the May ballot in the coming weeks.
Oregon regulators approve a key permit for the next energy biofuel refinery on the Columbia River. The company plans to make renewable diesel and sustainable aviation fuel in Port Westward, outside of Clatskanie and Columbia County. The Department of Environmental Quality okayed a water quality certification for NEXT. That was the last step in getting a federal permit from the Army Corps of Engineers. DEQ denied the permit twice before. Environmental groups worry about the explosive risk of storing and transporting fuel so close to and on the Columbia River. Environmental groups also call biofuels a, quote, false climate solution that ultimately replaces the climate impact of oil, drilling with high carbon footprint feedstocks. The refinery would also be built on an unstable soil in a region threatened by a major Cascadian subduction zone earthquake.
A gold mining project in Idaho has received approval from the U.S. Forest Service to advance. Critics say that it will harm water and public health. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
The U.S. Forest Service has given the go-ahead for a gold mining project in central Idaho. If it receives state permits, the Stibnite Gold Project will be located in the Payette National Forest and become one of the largest gold mines in the country. John Robison with the Idaho Conservation League says it's especially concerning for the East Fork, South Fork Salmon River watershed, where the mine will be located, and because of downstream effects from the mine.
We're really concerned about the Forest Service's decision that disregarded some recommended protections for the area and some additional sideboards on this mine project, and both short-term and long-term impacts to public health and clean water in the area.
The Nez Perce tribe also criticized the decision, saying the mine violates their treaty rights and that the Forest Service notes in its final report that the mine will harm fish habitat. The company behind the mine, Perpetual Resources, applauded the decision. In a joint statement, Idaho's congressional delegation also celebrated it, saying the mine would increase the U.S.'s supply of critical minerals, reducing reliance on China. The delegation says the mine will increase the country's supply of antimony, which can be used to make ammunition and batteries. But Robison says they're overestimating the mine's importance. He says there's only a 3-year supply of antimony at the site, and that gold accounts for 96% of the project's profits.
It really is a gold mine, and the vast majority of gold is used for jewelry or for hoarding wealth. So it really isn't a material that society needs.
Robison adds the mining of critical minerals is necessary, but it should be done in the least harmful way.
One of the things that we've learned is we have to do so more responsibly than we've done in the past. And we're concerned we're going to get the same result from this mine project, which is contaminated landscape that will persist for decades, if not centuries.
The mine project still needs state permits to advance. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
House lawmakers take aim at the International Criminal Court. Former President Jimmy Carter is laid to rest in his hometown of Plains, Georgia. And another fight looms over the Affordable Care Act. With more on that story, it's Catherine Carley with the 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I would note that our problems aren't just the dangerous terrorist organizations like Hamas, but these international organizations given power over our citizens and our way of life.
Texas Republican Representative Chip Roy says the International Criminal Court should not be able to prosecute Americans or U.S. allies like Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's under court arrest order. The Republican-led House just passed a bill imposing sanctions on any ICC officials who try. Former President Jimmy Carter was laid to rest in Plains, Georgia, after a Washington eulogy by his friend and successor, President Joe Biden.
Throughout his life, he showed us what it means to be a practitioner of good works and a good and faithful servant of God and of the people. And today, many think he was from a bygone era.
Biden said Carter might seem old-fashioned in placing service above his own ambitions, but the 39th president foresaw a future of racial tolerance and clean energy. President-elect Donald Trump will face sentencing in his New York hush money trial today after the Supreme Court refused to impose a last-minute delay. He's not expected to face any penalties. Meanwhile, Trump said to be preparing 100 executive orders, including reinstating Title 42, a pandemic policy used to expel migrants. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen represents Oklahoma.
Just as long as we deliver for the American people on securing the border, on energy independence, on getting the regulations rolled back.
Democrats in Congress have reintroduced legislation to stop Affordable Care Act marketplace insurance subsidies from expiring. Laura Packard is a Virginia healthcare advocate and cancer survivor.
If they had stripped away my insurance while I was going through treatments, today I would be bankrupt or dead because it costs hundreds of thousands of dollars to save my life.
Trump has also vowed to repeal the ACA, which is now used by a record 42 million people. Looking to bounce back, state Democratic parties are organizing community forums to hear directly from voters. Massachusetts Democratic Party Chair Steve Kerrigan says he wants to hear from the more than a third of registered voters who chose not to vote.
Sitting out an election should not be an option. When our voice isn't heard, election results might not result the way we want them to be. And we've got to push back against that sort of apathy.
About 40% of folks under 30 cast ballots last year, down significantly from 2020. Next Gen America's Christina Sinsoon Ramirez says Democrats could reach them by highlighting education and good-paying union jobs.
These are winning policies, but they need to be at the forefront of their campaigns to be able to win. And there has to be deep investment also in key portions of the electorate.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Once Upon a Time. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 37 degrees. And tomorrow's weather will also be cloudy with a high of 46. Today in history, in 1980, the New England Journal of Medicine publishes the letter Addiction Rare in Patients Treated with Narcotics, which is later misused by the pharmaceutical industry to downplay the general risk of addiction to opioids. The quote of the day is from British singer David Bowie, who died this day in 2016. He said, quote, "Aging is an extraordinary process. If you are pining for youth, I think it produces a stereotypical old man because you only live in memory. You live in a place that doesn't exist. I think aging is an extraordinary process whereby you become the person that you always should have been."
The Klamath Tribe's fire crew heads to Southern California to help fight the LA County wildfires. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Klamath Tribes, which are comprised of the Klamath, Modoc, and Yahooskin people, have sent help down to Southern California to fight the massive wildfires. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
The Klamath tribe sent a Type 3 fire engine and crew down to tackle the Eaton fire, which was nearing 14,000 acres Thursday night. The incident command post is at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena. William Ray Jr. is chairman for the Klamath tribes. He says the crew will be on the fire line no later than Friday morning.
You know, we had a lot of help in Oregon, in our backyard, from Southern California crews, and we're just returning the favor in their time of need and want to just show that the tribes are supportive with our crews that we have available with all Indian spirit of giving.
Ray says the Klamath tribes and U.S. Forest Service will jointly be sending a second engine and crew down before the weekend. Both deployments are equipped for 14 days. More fires are expected across Southern California due to ongoing dry weather and powerful Santa Ana winds through early next week. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
On Thursday, Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin said in a social media post that a team of Navajo wildland firefighters has been deployed to Southern California to help battle the fires. He says the Navajo Scouts, a team of 23 members, including a female firefighter, are highly trained to fight fires like these. Members of the team are from various communities across the Navajo Nation. In Alaska, a Kodiak Island resident has been honored with a national award for environmental leadership. One of 8 awardees, Natasha Hayden, was recognized for her work advocating for Alaska Native fishing rights. KMXT's Davis Hovey has more.
When the Center for Rural Affairs in Nebraska contacted Natasha Hayden to tell her she'd won a national award, she says she almost thought it was a scam.
Also in the you know, today's climate of where people are reaching out to you to try to get you to send them money and send you your personal information, there is quite a bit of skepticism about it. It's like, oh, somebody's cold calling me basically to say you've won this award.
But the award was real. It acknowledges a range of advocacy work Hayden has been doing for Alaska Native people on Kodiak Island, including her tribe of the Native village of Afognak, for years. Over those last 10 years as a tribal council member, Hayden has focused on fisheries advocacy and stewardship of marine mammals around Kodiak Island. Hayden is also part of the Kodiak Island Tribal Coalition, which represents the Kodiak Archipelago's 10 tribes. She says various villages in the region have lost 50 to 100% of their commercial fishing permits and a larger outmigration from those communities over the course of a few decades.
Seeing this severe negative impact and working towards restoring access to those fisheries that are right outside of our back door has been primary, and it's intertwined with everything.
Hayden says she is building on the resource management work that was done by generations preceding her, which she says future generations will take up as well.
And I take a lot, I mean, a huge amount of comfort from the belief that the Aleutic people have been here for thousands of years and that we're still going to be here in 1,000 years.
Hayden will receive $25,000 as part of her 2024 Environmental Leader Award. Other awardees include a Meskwaki artist and farmer from Iowa, an indigenous food sovereignty advocate in Louisiana, and a Diné environmental scientist in Arizona. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Hovey.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Advocates for migrant workers are sounding the alarm about the impact mass deportations could have on farm workers, the U.S. food system, and the economy. Leaders say those who work in essential industries like agriculture face mounting fears and are organizing to protect their rights and livelihoods. Shantia Hudson reports from North Carolina.
Organizations supporting farm workers are ramping up efforts to protect immigrant laborers in light of looming mass deportation threats. About 40% of farm workers are not authorized to legally work in the U.S., according to the Department of Agriculture. But Elizabeth Wally with the Food Chain Workers Alliance says immigrants play critical roles in keeping North Carolina's grocery shelves stocked and local economies afloat. She explains the possibility of large-scale immigration crackdowns has fueled anxiety among these workers, many of whom already endure harsh working conditions.
Something that is a consistent problem for farm workers is obviously people using their status as a way to control them, right? Whether you are undocumented or if you are like an H-2A visa temporary worker, that's like really an ongoing theme that's obviously going to be ramped up.
About 100,000 farm workers call North Carolina home. Wally says these workers are essential not only to the food system, but the broader economy. The Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy found in 2022, undocumented workers paid almost $700 million in North Carolina state and local taxes. Beyond immigration threats, Wally cites growing concerns about potential rollbacks to labor protections. She says farm workers' advocates have long fought for safeguards against extreme heat and unsafe working conditions, but these gains are now at risk. She adds attacks on the National Labor Relations Board could weaken worker protections further.
Definitely concerned about what's going to happen to the National Labor Relations Board. Elon Musk and other CEOs of corporations have been kind of attacking the NLRB for the last couple years.
Wally notes some farmers are also voicing concerns about potential disruptions to their workforce. She thinks increased reliance on H-2A visa workers to fill these gaps could heighten the risk of exploitation within the system. So Wally says advocacy groups are trying to equip farm workers with the resources they need to navigate an uncertain future, such as legal or financial assistance.
Focusing on stuff like Know Your Rights trainings, which could be anything about how to deal with ICE, how to deal with your employer, how to prepare for being caught up in the immigration system. Also a lot of rapid response networks.
North Carolina is home to almost 300,000 undocumented immigrants. For North Carolina News Service, I'm Shantia Hudson.
At a university in Florida, a creative collaboration between the art and ornithology departments is addressing the widespread issue of birds hitting windows. By incorporating scientifically proven patterns of dots and line drawings of local bird species, the installation makes glass surfaces visible to birds, reducing fatal strikes. Tramiel Gomez has more on the story.
With a thud, the tranquil sounds of nature are shattered as a bird crashes into a glass window. It's an all-too-common deadly occurrence that students at one Florida university are working to minimize. The reflective surfaces of buildings trick birds into thinking they're flying toward the open sky or trees, only to meet a fatal impact. These collisions are responsible for millions of bird deaths every year. And at Florida Gulf Coast University, students and faculty are taking creative steps to tackle this silent crisis. Ornithology professor Oscar Johnson says bird window collisions are a major threat to wild bird populations.
Some studies estimate as many as 1 billion birds die every single year just in the United States due to collisions with windows. It's a major problem. You know, obviously it's a global problem, it's a national problem, it really happens everywhere. So anywhere that you live, guarantee that this is something that needs to be worked on.
So the school's ornithology club teamed up with campus art galleries to create an art installation that deters birds from flying into reflective glass. The design uses repeated patterns of dots or lines to break up reflections, which prevents birds from mistaking the glass for an open sky. The project combines science and art to reduce fatal collisions. The installation covers a large window at the campus art gallery entrance and features line drawings of local bird species. Johnson says the project aims to expand across campus and beyond, with plans to make the designs publicly available for homeowners and businesses.
The drawings that we did, we're going to be producing them and depositing them on the FGC website. Well, they'll be downloadable. You just print them out on a piece of paper, put them up against the glass, and you can trace the drawing on the outside of the glass. It is important that it has to be on the exterior in order to break up that reflection.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife also recommends similar tips to curb the problem. Johnson encourages communities to take proactive steps to protect birds from these avoidable collisions. This is Tramiel Gomes for Florida News Connection.
Electric cars are becoming more popular, but sometimes it takes time for people to get used to charging their car instead of going to the gas station. Smarter EV charging could ease the strain on the electric grid. Certain software can help drivers charge when renewable energy is available and electricity demand is slow. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As more people buy EVs, charging them could strain the electric grid, especially if everyone charges at times when electricity use is already high.
Typically, electricity demand is at its highest when people are getting home from work, turning on the lights, cooking dinner, running laundry.
Kendall Cody is with a startup called WeaveGrid. She says when demand is high, utilities sometimes need to turn on backup power plants, which often use dirtier fossil fuels. And it's expensive. So WeaveGrid develops software that utilities can offer to customers who own EVs to optimize the times when they charge.
They'll plug in and we'll basically shift the time that that car is charging to sometime usually in the middle of the night, sometimes in the middle of the day when there's a lot of solar power available, so that the car is charging when there's not a lot of strain on the electric grid or when there's a lot of renewable electricity availability, either like the wind is blowing or the sun is shining.
WeaveGrid is partnering with utilities in Alabama, Georgia, Maryland, and elsewhere to offer the platform to drivers and help accelerate the transition to a cleaner transportation future. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Now, we go to The Point Puzzle, the weekly radio brain teaser produced by Pearl Stark at KPOV, Bend. This week, the wordplay puzzle focuses on opposites.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, to mark the first quarter of the 21st century, I started with a set of four things. Start with one copy of each unique letter, add an additional letter, and rearrange to get tough answer. Well, the answer is north, south, east, and west. Add a G and rearrange. Our winner this week is Eva, who listens to KPOV in Bend, Oregon. For the new puzzle, I've been thinking about opposites. I came up with three words, 4 letters, 5 letters, and 6 letters, that all mean outside or the outside edge, and all contain the word in inside them. What are they? So again, send me 3 words, 4 letters, 5 letters, and 6 letters, that all mean outside edge and contain the word in inside them. When you have an answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday. Opposite you. This is Ben Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of January 6th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 10th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Shantia Hudson, Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, Tramel Gomes, Pearl Stark, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7.